Hi, I'm Chloe McCulloch, editorial director of Building Magazine. This year is the 180th anniversary of our publication, and to mark this, we've launched the Building the Future Commission, one aspect of which looks at how we can build sustainable and desirable communities that people actually want to live in. The Commission is looking for best practice in urban design, and this is the accompanying podcast. Welcome to Building Talks, Creating Communities. New developments can face massive opposition, attacked for poor design, a lack of public services, and low quality civic space. These are the challenges we'll be tackling in this podcast by talking to built environment professionals. We'll explore their personal stories, influences, and motivations. And we'll ask, why is there so much interest in the placemaking agenda? And how can we make the places we work and live in better? Hello and welcome to the Building Talks Creating Communities podcast. I'm Chloe McCulloch and as usual, I'm joined by my colleague, Ben Flatman, who has spent the last few weeks talking to key players in this field. Hi, Ben. Tell us about this week's guest.
This week's guest is David Rudlin. He's a very well-known and highly respected planner and urban designer. For many years, he was a director at Urbed in Manchester, and he is currently urban design director at BDP.
And what was it particularly about David that made you want to interview him?
Well, I think one of the brilliant things about David is that he brings a perspective from outside of London. I think these conversations can get very London-centric. David's from Birmingham originally, but he moved to Manchester as a student, fell in love with the city, and has been working from there ever since. And I think that gives us a really useful counterpoint to a lot of the other conversations that we've had in the series. David is passionate about Manchester. He loves the city. He was very closely involved in the regeneration of Hume several decades ago. And he's just a brilliant advocate for what has happened there.
Okay, so let's have a listen.
Hello, David. Welcome to the podcast series, and thank you so much for hosting us today in the BDP offices in Clerkenwell in London. I know you've come down to London from Manchester, where you're normally based, North Wales as well. We're in a very interesting late 19th century building that's been converted into the BDP office. Do you know anything about the history of this place?
Yeah, I believe it was a brewery. And it's still a novelty to me to come down here because I'm based, as you say, in Manchester, and I do work from home in North Wales. So it's great to have this base in London, and it's still a novelty for me to be down here.
Well, thanks so much for having us. The theme of the series is placemaking, and I just wanted to start by asking you, why is placemaking so important, and what do you see as the key challenges for people seeking to create or reinvigorate a sense of place?
First of all, I'm a bit suspicious about placemaking as a term. It's become the thing that we use in recent years, but it's a bit of a meaningless term. I mean, I think I've always loved being in urban areas, whether that be a village or a market town or a large city. And there's a certain quality to that. It's quality to the space that you're in, the quality with the way the space is occupied, the way that the buildings and the intensity of life and so on. And to be honest, in the UK, we've been really poor at creating this. I mean, we can preserve the areas we've got, but we very rarely produce really good new urban spaces. Traveling around Europe and experiencing places elsewhere, and you come back to the UK and think, we're actually just not good at this at all. And actually, my entire career has been trying to work out why that is and how we can change that. So I think it's I'm not sure I'm doing very well. I mean, I'm sure I'm actually succeeding greatly, but I think, getting the British to be able to build towns and cities better is a lifetime's work.
Before we sort of move on to your own sort of life experiences and background, I was just wondering if you could give an example of where you think it has been done well in the UK, a sort of contemporary example or one from recent history.
Well, if you forgive me for choosing one which I have been involved in, but I mean, Manchester is the great case study, I think. And Manchester, there's a story about the process in Manchester, which starts with the Olympic Games, when they were bidding for the Olympic Games and they lost out to Barcelona. And when the senior people from Manchester went to Barcelona as part of that process, they didn't lose to Barcelona, they lost to Sydney, didn't they? But Barcelona was hosting the Olympics when they were bidding. And they realised that Manchester was just awful compared to Barcelona. You know, and what they realised, it wasn't the cathedrals or the concert halls. It was just the basic quality of urban realm in the city. And so they came back and they set to work on redeveloping Hume, which is where I have in the past been a planning officer in Hume, and I lived in Hume for a time. Hume was, for those of you who don't know, massive council estate right on the edge of the city centre, about 6,000 homes. And they knocked down most of it. And they wanted to build it as a new urban quarter. And it's been done. I mean, this was 20 years ago, 25 years ago, and it's now built. And I think it's probably, I mean, it's not as good as some people who have heard about it think it is. It's just basically okay, which is a pretty high achievement in the UK. And Manchester, because it then changed the design guidance for the city as a whole, it introduced what we would now call design codes for the city as a whole. All of the stuff going on Manchester over the year has been okay, and I use okay as advisedly, because I think actually as urban designers, if we can get everything to be okay, then we're doing well. Then we can then strive for excellence, above that. But getting to okay is good, and Manchester is thriving as a result of it. You know, in terms of its placemaking, in terms of its new developments, I think it's probably the best example in the UK.
Thanks, David. I'd just like to speak to you about your personal journey and where you started. I know that you grew up in Birmingham, so I've got a particular interest in this subject because I also spent some formative years of my childhood there. You've spoken in the past about having visited an architect's office in the city centre when you were younger and that having a sort of big impact on you. I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit more about that.
Well, I think more widely, yeah, I'm slightly older than you, I think. So I grew up in Birmingham in the 60s and 70s. I think the important thing about that period was that modernism hadn't yet been sort of discredited. And so my parents were incredibly proud of the stuff that was happening in Birmingham when, you know, relatives used to visit. They were taken to see the new Bullring shopping centre and the Queensway and all the stuff in the town centre, because it was seen as the future. And it was still shiny and new, and people still were very excited about the transformation that was happening in Birmingham. And as a school kid, as you say, I was taken on trips to the architect's office on the top of the Rotunda and doing photographic projects in Alpha Tower and studying in the Central Library. And that was, you know, that was living in the future. And I think it wasn't long after that that people started to get sort of get tarnished in terms of it, and it didn't last, but also people started to have a very different attitude to Birmingham. But I remember when it was still exciting.
Why do you think that sense of optimism and excitement turned to sort of disillusionment, and why did Birmingham turn so sort of virulently against its 20th century modernist environment, built environment?
Well, I think I'd give two answers. The first is that modernist buildings are one thing, but modernist urbanism is another. And actually, modernist town planning or urbanism just doesn't work, in my view. I mean, it just creates spaces which are not pleasant places to be. And, you know, the idea of just walking through Birmingham on a wet winter's day through the underpasses and so on, it just didn't feel safe. It didn't feel nice. It didn't feel lively and populated with people. Yeah, I've always said I love modern buildings, but modern town planning is a disaster. I also think modernism has a bigger problem in that it doesn't wear well. Whereas traditional places actually get better as they get older, they get more varied, and all the incremental change just adds to the character. I think modernism looks best on the first day it's opened and then deteriorates thereafter. And I think that's one of the problems of modernism, and that you don't have that ability to evolve with time without undermining the original idea of the architects.
So modernist architecture is less sort of adaptable, perhaps?
Yeah, it's less like a pair of jeans, which sort of wears well as it gets older. It's more like a pristine designer piece of clothing, which, you know, never looks quite as good as it did on the first day.
Was that fascination with the built environment there from a young age for you, or is it something that you sort of came to a little bit later?
It was, yeah. I mean, I wrote in the first book I did about, I used to travel from, I lived in South Birmingham, Hall Green, Moseley area, and I used to travel into town on the bus on the Stratford Road. And the Stratford Road, unlike the centre of Birmingham, was just extraordinary. It was like a 5-10 mile stretch of a road, lined with shops down either side, going through all these different communities of ethnic communities in Birmingham, and looking off into the streets on either side, which seemed to go on forever. And you know, I had this sort of fascination with the city, as opposed to particular buildings. It was the city that I really got. And so when my career officer told me that my maths wasn't strong enough to do architecture, which is the strangest piece of advice I've ever gotten, because I've never come across very many numerate architects, I ended up doing planning instead, which turned out for me to be a good choice. I think a few years later it would have been a very bad choice, but I did planning at a time when it was still quite an interesting thing to do. So I went to Manchester University School of Town Planning. It's great that at that time planning was a design course. We shared a building with the architects. We had mirrored studios to the architects. We had a studio per year, so you moved along the building as you went through the year. All our projects were design-based drawings. We did civic design, really, and I got taught to be an urban designer in the way that planners just aren't taught to be urban designers anymore. And we worked alongside the architects, and it was a very creative place to be. We did master plans, we designed new towns, which sounds a bit strange now, but there was a really interesting creative atmosphere in the school.
Would this have been in the 70s or early
80s? I started in 79, so I was there for the first few years of the 80s, and very soon after I left they got rid of the drawing boards, and then planning turned into a much more technocratic degree and became much more legalistic. And the planners they produced went into development management, or development control as it was called at the time, or they went into plan making, or they went to the work of the private sector and spent all their time screwing planning permission out of reluctant authorities. It became that sort of a different type of profession, whereas I was taught to do master plans and housing layouts and all that stuff, which then architects, it seems that became the architect's job, whereas in my day, it was very much what the planners did.
Obviously, there were sort of massive changes taking place politically and economically at that time, sort of end of the 70s, early 80s. Do you think the changes that you're describing in planning reflected what was going on in government and, the Thatcher government in particular?
Well, the Thatcher government didn't have a lot of time for planning. They saw it as an interference in the free market. And so planning was very much downgraded as a profession. I mean, a few years before my time, town planners were heroes. Town planners were the people who were changing the world and who were envisaging the future and building these new modernist town centres and housing estates and so on. And so in a sense, hero planner to someone who's slightly irrelevant is a big journey. And I think both of them are unjustified. I don't think the hero planner is a useful idea, but neither is the sort of bureaucratic person just pushing planning applications across a desk. We need to find a middle ground, and I think planning has a real role to rediscover in terms of creating good places. I'll try and avoid using the word placemaking.
You've talked about the quality of new places in the UK being not generally particularly high. When do you think things went wrong? Is it when we sort of consciously started creating new places?
No, we used to be quite good at it. 1947 Town Planning Act is probably the date that I choose, because if you look a little bit earlier than that, you look at Edinburgh Newtown, Bloomsbury, Bath, look at all those examples of planned towns. We were really good at this stuff, and actually I wrote a book called Climax City, which was very much about the process by which we build new places, and this idea that landowners would lay out sites and create codes, and that the area would develop over a period of time following the code in an evolutionary sort of way. And that all disappeared with the new planning system. And in the planning system, I think part of the problem was that we had this idea that planning was about creating plans, and those plans would get built. And so planners spent a long time designing new towns or new town centres, and they generally built the thing as they planned it. And then there was a rump of planning, which was about controlling what the private sector did, which at the time was of 1947 was seen as being the lesser important of the two. Planners would build places and they'd also control the private sector. And so that system was then very ill prepared for a system where the private sector builds everything and the public sector builds virtually nothing. So this idea of planning permission, which is essentially saying that we will refuse something that's unacceptable, but we have no ability to promote what is acceptable, unless you come up with it, we can only refuse what's in front of us rather than promote something that's good, has just left us with a system which is not really fit for purpose. And I think most people now agree that that's the case. We need to reform our planning system quite badly.
I mean, the examples you gave of good urbanism were all sort of Georgian, I think, or that sort of that kind of era. What does that tell us about the way
I could find later examples. I think there are 20th century, early 20th century examples. I mean, I think a lot of the garden city estates that were built around our cities in the 20th century, early 20th century, are also very good. We were talking about Bourneville earlier. There are examples more recent than that. It's not all Georgian. Victorians did it quite well as well. But that process by which we build places doesn't really happen anymore. And it does elsewhere in the world. I mean, when you look at, you know, international systems, that process of code-based planning is the norm. It's part of what the planning system is based upon. And so it does happen elsewhere, and there are more contemporary examples. So yeah, I don't want to get trapped into saying, you know, the Georgians had all the answers and we need to go back to the Georgians. I think it's about a process and a way of thinking about places.
So you finish your studies in Manchester, and you decided to stay in the city.
Yeah, I like Manchester a lot. I think a lot of people fall in love with the place they go to university in. I think that's not unusual. But Manchester had a lot going for it. I mean, having said that, you know, I've just been reading a book by Andy Spinoza called Manchester Unspun, who's an exact contemporary of mine in Manchester, and it was pretty run down. When I was there as a student, it was a real, you know, there was a lot of dereliction. It had lost a lot of population, but at the same time, it had the hacienda and it had factory records and it had the buzz of all that stuff, interesting stuff going on. So it was a pretty obvious decision to stay there. And yeah, I got a job with the council, 5 years in the city council at a time when the planning department had 120 people in it. I think it's now got about 20 in the planning department. So, you know, we did interesting stuff. And yeah, I spent 5 years there before deciding to move on. So yeah, I like Manchester a lot. I think it's my adopted home, certainly.
Of all the regional English cities, Manchester always feels to me like the one that really has a sense of itself and also a sort of very strong and confident sort of local culture. I mean, in terms of music, but also, you know, its urbanism. Is that still there, do you think? Or are there sort of concerns?
Yeah, it's definitely still there. I mean, I think Glasgow has it as well. And Liverpool clearly does. Those northern cities have that strong sense of identity. But Manchester had it even when it was on its knees. You know, it had that sort of irrational pride and arrogance about it. Arrogance is what Manchester is all about, actually. There's a lot of... The sort of charm of the place, sort of unabashed arrogance, and you can see it in the music, but you can also see it in some of the developers and the people who've been really influential in the city, and the footballers as well, of course. It's what Manchester's all about, and that's what saw it through. And that confidence that it, you know, it's interesting. Birmingham always says it's second city. Manchester says it's not second to anyone. You know, it has that. It doesn't compare itself to other cities. It's just what it is.
So we've talked a bit about, you know, what went wrong with British planning. Have we learned the lessons?
No, we haven't. Of course we haven't. You know, I was involved just before the pandemic with Matthew Carmona doing the audit of new housing. And, you know, the majority of schemes were mediocre, which was seen as a slight improvement on crap, which is what they were before. So we're still not good at this stuff. We're still producing poor quality environments. We still can't build new places which are anything like as rich as older places. So we haven't reformed the planning system. We haven't reformed the way of doing big scale developments. There are some examples of which are better, but still a lot of it's not very good. So we haven't reformed it. I mean, the planning white paper, which was published a few years ago now, did start to recognize this. And, you know, whilst it was produced by a sort of conservative government, which is not necessarily my political complexion, I thought it had a lot of good stuff in it. And it was interesting to see government starting to recognize these points. But whether that will ever come back, I suspect not now. So we're in a point where we'll have to start that process again.
I was going to say, one of my perceptions is that it's actually the centre-right that has been far more vocal and apparently interested in the built environment over the last few years than the left.
Yeah.
Does that raise concerns for you with the prospect of a Labour government coming in? I mean, I know that prior to 1997, New Labour was talking a lot about urbanism. You know, they had sort of Richard Rodgers as an advisor. I don't see any sign of that discussion taking place within Labour at the moment.
That actually didn't happen until a few years later. So, I mean, it's interesting that in the 90s, John Gummer was pushing, it was called Quality in Town and Country, I think it was called, which was a conservative idea of promoting good quality design. And Labour wasn't interested when it first got in. And it was only 2 years later that Prescott became Deputy Prime Minister and Rogers was involved and so on, and Labour got really into it. And I think we're in a similar position now. I don't see anyone in Labour really talking about these issues, if or when. I'm not sure where we are with that now, but I suspect we will have a Labour government in the not-too-distant future. And I hope they do pick up on this, but I'm not really getting anything back from them at all at the moment.
For the time being, we do have a Conservative government, and they have been talking quite a lot about these issues. And you've been closely involved in the design coding discussion, and you sort of helped write the national model design code. Mm-hmm. I was wondering if you just tell us a little bit about that, and perhaps just reference the Building Better, Building Beautiful Commission.
Yeah, well, I wrote about the Building Better, Building Beautiful Commission in BD, and you know, we were all a bit suspicious, I think it's fair to say. Particularly under Roger Scruton's initial chairmanship, that it was basically saying, you know, traditionalist design agendas are the ones we should be pursuing. I think under Nicholas Boyd-Smith it did transform, and actually the final report was pretty good. And I think a lot of architects said that they actually were surprised. They were surprised by how good that report was. One of the things of in the design agenda is that we shouldn't be relying on exceptionalism. We shouldn't say the only good places we can create are when you get a really good designer. The key thing about design is to get it so that the normal is good. The everyday is much better than it is, and the way you do that is through coding. So most planning systems in the world are based upon coding, and the idea of a code is that each piece of land is zoned, and that zoning has a set of rules attached to it, and those rules are non-negotiable. And so basically you have to follow the rules. And what happens in a code-based system is the developers don't even bother to challenge it because they know that it's a non-negotiable set of rules. They just build within the rules. And we shouldn't get carried away, because a crap set of rules creates a crap environment. And, you know, suburban America is based upon this coding system, and you can get low-density suburbia through coding as much as you can get Manhattan, which is also coded. But the rules then are the things which regulate the form that you create. So rather than designing a place, you write rules for it. It's like coding a computer code. You're writing a code, and that generates a program. And you write an urban code, and that generates a form of urbanism. And so this was something that I got very interested in the book I wrote, Climax City. And it goes back to those Georgian developers, which are also code-based systems. And how essentially what a code does is regulate a naturally self-organizing system, as opposed to pretending that it can impose its own design on it. And that's why codes are so important. And then, you know, Andy Bombradsky, who was the government's chief architect, picked up on that. He'd made a commitment to produce a national model design code. We tendered for it along with various other people, but the Climax City book was something that I think he picked up on as an approach. And yeah, we were fortunate enough to get commissioned to do that. And it's a zonal system. Well, we couldn't use the word zone because zonal system is seen as a continental system. So we invented this idea called area types, which are basically zones, and created a process by which we can do a code-based planning system. The problem in the UK is that we still have a discretionary planning system. And so developers are not going to say those rules are fixed and therefore I'll just follow them and not argue. The developers in the UK are programmed to argue about everything because they know a discretionary system, it's always worth pushing your luck with things. And the big question, I think, is about how coding is going to work in the UK. And we're working on a few codes now. BDP are working on a couple of codes. And it's, you know, we're finding our way along with a whole bunch of other people about how to write these things. But what will be interesting in the years to come is how they get applied and whether they really have teeth.
Do you think local authorities are geared up and ready to embrace this new system?
I think they're not. I mean, clearly. I mean, they are. The planning systems in the UK are cut to the bone. I mean, they don't have the resources. They don't have the skills. But I mean, one of the things, and we've talked about this before, the idea of coding is that actually you don't need to be highly skilled. You're just getting people to follow a set of rules. And you need a basic set of understanding to do that, but you don't need to be a skilled urban designer. Most planners should do this. And this is why it shouldn't just be the urban design officer who's responsible for this. All development managers should just have coding as part of what they do. And so, yeah, there is some upskilling to do, but not in sometimes the way we need all planners to be experts in urban design. I think it should just be integrated into what they do.
So your new book is out shortly. I think by the time this podcast is broadcast, it might be in shops already. I was wondering if you just tell us a little bit about it and how it came to be.
Yeah, we were commissioned. Well, we applied to the commission for the 1851 exhibition, which is a fund which provides a 2-yearly built environment fellowship. They set the theme. In fact, the theme was the crisis on the high streets, and so we bid into that. We were successful. My colleagues Vicky Payne and Lucy Montagu through Urban Plus wanted to tell stories. Basically, the feeling we had was that. The data tells one story about high streets, and it's not a very, very optimistic one. But actually, each high street, each town centre has its own narrative. We took 100 case studies, and we explored them partly through data that we bought from Experian, but partly just through talking to people and interviewing people locally and visiting the place and reading local press stories and so on, and just trying to get under the skin about what's really happening on high streets. And that's what the book is really about. It's called High Street. It doesn't just do the stories. It puts that together into a longer narrative about the British high street, which has really been in crisis since the war. I mean, actually, you know, we talk about five crises on the high street, but the first one was when the supermarkets really undermined the high street. And then another one in the 90s when the out-of-town development took place. And then the clone town stuff, which happened in the 2000s. And then the financial crisis. And now the current crisis that's happening. And it's bounced back from all of them. So that's the positive news. Current crisis is much more about big retail than it is about town centres. And actually, the data was all showing a slight uptick in the vacancy. The vacancy rate was dropping slightly, but what I mean, the uptick in activity in town centres. Difficult, obviously, because it's been screened by the COVID pandemic, which makes it difficult to look at the trends. But it seems to me that, you know, independents are taking over where the multiples once reigned, and the high street is sort of starting to self-heal, as it were.
What are the really positive stories that come out of the book?
Well, a few examples, I guess. So, we talk about Barnsley being an interesting place. So Barnsley, and I wrote about this actually in my recent BD column, and Barnsley has now redeveloped its shopping centre, which was bought by the public sector as a result of the Will Alsop work back in the 90s, 2000s. They built it themselves, which is what I think is one thing that's really interesting. So rather than go out, find a private developer to partner with them and then be beholden to that developer in terms of bringing it forward, they built the shopping centre themselves with public money, public borrowing. They're subsidising it with public money because it's regenerating the town. And they say more jobs are created in the town centre than anywhere else. And so why shouldn't we invest in this? And this idea, it goes back to the old markets. The markets were all built by councils back in the day. This idea that town centres are a public asset rather than a private commodity, I think is really interesting. So that's a really good example. Lots of examples of marketplace like Froome, to take a different type of place where the market, which they started in the town centre, has been taken and now takes over the town and includes all sorts of businesses and really enlivens what, again, was quite a rundown place for a while. And this idea of localism and independence is really important.
Thanks, David. I was just wondering if you had three suggestions to improve the quality of placemaking. I know that's a term that you're skeptical about, but if you had three suggestions for improving the way in which we create new places or enhance existing places in the UK, what would they be?
Well, the first one, I think, as you probably won't be surprised to hear, is reform of the planning system and planning, which is based on a more code-based, less discretionary system where there's a degree of certainty about how things can take place. I think the second one is about reinventing the role of the master developer. I think I'm a master planner. I mean, it's a horrible word, and master planning, we need to find a new word for this because it doesn't, it isn't a great phrase. But I think master planners require master developers, and master developers are people who aren't necessarily going to develop every building in a place, but are going to curate the way that building comes forward, and they do so on the basis of a master plan. And so I think that is something which we need, and we have people who call themselves master developers, and people like Arjun are, you know, do it very well, and you and I and so on. So the people are doing that, but they still have this sense that they're going to build most things in the area. And I think master developers are much more about corralling and curating development by others, which is important. And then to pick a small thing, I'm chair of a couple of design panels, design review panels in Nottingham and Sheffield, and I think they are a really good collaborative way of talking about design and making it relevant locally. Years ago, I was part of the CABE panel for a while when Paul Finch was the chair, and I learned a lot from the way that CABE happened. And, you know, we meet monthly in Nottingham and Sheffield, and we sit down with developers, with other architects and professionals from the town, and we have very, very positive collaborative discussions about design quality. And it seems to me we've lost a bit of that in the wider process. It's about, you know, combine a code with that type of discussion and you've got the best of both worlds. You've got peers talking about design and encouraging excellence whilst you've also got a code mandating the basics, get the basics right.
Thanks, David. It's been really fascinating hearing your thoughts about the current state of urbanism within the UK. I'd just like to finish with three questions that we're asking all of the guests on this series. And the first of those is really just asking you for a sort of personal example of a place that you love. I think we all have an idea of what makes a good place. And I think that often sort of derives from experiences that we've had.
I mean, I guess from personal history, I'm married to my wife, Hélène, who's French and spent a long time in various parts of France. But yeah, I always adored going to Paris and feeling the particular atmosphere that city has, which I think is unlike any other city in the world. There was a time when I knew Paris better than I knew London. And so I think I'd probably choose Paris for that one.
The second question is what I'm calling the Poundbury question. It's drawn mixed responses from people. I think it's sort of been construed by some as a sort of culture wars type question. And that really isn't what I'm trying to get at. I suppose the reason I'm asking this question is that it seems to be a rare example in the UK of a mixed use town extension that we don't see a lot of. And I was just wondering what your thoughts are about it and whether there are sort of useful lessons that not just traditionalist urbanists can sort of take away, but the sort of broader built environment community.
It's a shame, isn't it, that Poundbury has become that battleground between traditionalist and whatever the opposite of traditionalist is. I mean, Poundbury is incredible. To build a new urban extension, which has a reasonable amount of density, is such a mix and such a massive amount of jobs in it, as a mixed-use area, is an incredible achievement. But if that was designed in a completely different way, it would still be an incredible achievement. I don't think the architect has anything to do with that achievement, and so I applaud it for that. And it is an example of some of the things I've been talking about in terms of master plan-based, incremental code-based urbanism. It is one of the best examples of that. And the architecture is completely irrelevant to that discussion.
Finally, I'd just like to ask if you could name somebody in the industry, not necessarily a planner or an urbanist, but somebody in the built environment who you think is making a real positive impact at the moment.
I thought about this and I wanted to say Nick Folk, because Nicholas Folk has been very important to me in my career. He was an inspiration when I started joining Urbed, and I think he's changed the face of the way we do urbanism in the UK. Over the years, he invented the idea of urban regeneration. I've sort of talked about this before. I think Nick would be my first choice for that. But I think you then said currently making it, and Nick obviously, you know, I think probably is still currently making an impact, but maybe, you know, maybe not so much now as he was previously. Can I have a second one?
Sure.
I'm going to make two people, in fact. And I think, you know, clients of ours, but Johnny Anstead and Neil Murphy from Town as developers. They did the Marmalade Lane scheme, you may know, in Cambridge. And I think they are doing something quite important as developers. They're doing co-housing, first of all, which is a very different type of housing. They're doing it collaboratively with communities. They're producing really good design. They use good designers, and they are funding that. So there's a lot of sort of groups trying to do things like co-housing and so on and struggling with funding. But, you know, Neil used to work in the Treasury, and they've tapped into funding sources, and they're scaling this. And so I think, you know, people like that, I think, are a very important potential avenue in the future in terms of how we go about creating good places. It's not just the design, it's about the process that you create them with.
Thanks so much, David. It's been wonderful having you on the series.
Yeah, well, thank you for having me. It's been fun.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Building Talks Creating Communities podcast with me, Chloe McCulloch, and Ben Flatman. Our next episode is out on Tuesday. Ben will be talking to Anna Mansfield, Director at Publica. In the meantime, you can find out more about the Building the Future Commission at building.co.uk and more about urban design issues at our sister title, bdonline.co.uk. Thanks for listening and goodbye.